This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, a hospital in Northwest Wyoming is using telehealth to treat patients with opioid use disorder.
I feel close with them, and surprisingly, the patients report that they feel close with me as well.
Wind generation is taking off in southeastern Wyoming, but one new proposed development is not sitting well with rural homeowners who are nervous about its impacts.
But why right there? Which I'm sure gets the question everybody wants to know if you want to.
As the state nears an economic slowdown, one county has been continuing to grow.
The county that's been really seeing the impact of the oil drilling activity in the state has been Converse County.
We'll have those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. A new wind development is coming to Albany County. It's the latest in a flurry of new wind projects underway in southeastern Wyoming, a trend that's set to continue. But this development is facing pushback, with up to 151 turbines proposed to be built near a community of rural homeowners. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
South of Laramie, there's a road that goes straight into the plains. Over the hill, it's just open country and boulders, and eventually a tan house with a large porch facing the mountains.
I wake up every morning, go get a cup of coffee, and just look at the mountains, and it's really fun.
That's Missy Karam-Schuster, who's chosen to live outside of Laramie's downtown with her husband to enjoy the open view. But she's worried a new development called the Railtie Wind Project could impede that view. We're driving through about half of the development's proposed corridor, from her house to the recreational site Vitaville, about 15 minutes away. It goes a 15 minutes drive in the other direction from her house as well. The turbines could be as high as 675 feet.
So the windmills are supposed to go all to the back side of this property, all the way back here, and then they are supposed to sit on that hill, but everybody around this area will be able to see them.
Karam-Schuster points out her neighbor's properties, waves hello to a few passing cars, and she says she'd prefer it to stay like this.
Like, look at this beautiful view that we have out here, and yeah, I just can't imagine. It would look like an industrial park to me.
Karam-Schuster has concerns about the visual impacts, the noise, blinking lights, even health concerns. She's thought about moving.
I think about it sometimes, and I'm like, oh, I would want to move, or I would want to sell it before they, like, get building, and that way, because their property value is going to decrease immensely.
The Railtie project has just begun its regulatory process, and its developer, ConnectGen, still has little idea what kind of impacts it's going to have, say, with property values. It is also not determined exactly where turbines will go, how tall they'll be, or how many will be used.
Looks like we do still have some open seats up front.
Part of the regulatory process, of course, is public comment. During a recent scoping meeting in Laramie, the room was packed. I met one homeowner named Juan Reyes. He supports this project, saying turbines don't really bother him. Plus, he's leasing his land to the company.
It would benefit us greatly. Production agriculture is not really a rich boy's game, so we've struggled forever. But hopefully this would give us a boost.
Few others at the meeting were happy about it, though. Some raised concerns about the proximity to the National Historic Landmark Ames Monument. After a brief visit there, here's what the wind sounds like up there. Another worried about what the wind farms will do to his property value. Donning a black cowboy hat, Ryan Acey worries about the ranch he lives on. It surrounds the project area.
There's lots of other places they could put it. I know there's tons of houses down, it's going to affect a lot of people down there.
AC's biggest question, though, is simple.
But why right there? Which I'm sure, it's a question everybody wants to know too. But
when you drive through Wyoming, it does look like there's infinite available space to put a wind project. But Amanda McDonald says it's not that simple. She's the project manager at the meeting for ConnectGen.
You start layering in all of the constraints, environmental, transmission, compatible land use, the areas that are compatible with wind development, it starts to shrink down a lot.
And if it was in a remote area, McDonald says it would have to build the infrastructure to transport electricity, which isn't easy. These are all relatively new challenges for Southeast Wyoming, which has seen a major influx of new wind projects over the past 7 years. In fact, 7 of the past 9 new wind developments in the state have been there. Once online, those projects will more than triple Wyoming's current wind power generation. University of Wyoming Professor Jonathan Naughton is director of the Wind Energy Research Center. He says there are 2 big reasons Southeast Wyoming is seeing this bump in new wind development. Naughton says the first one, there's a rush to develop wind energy nationwide right now. The federal tax credit is expiring in 2021, which Railtie will take advantage of. New transmission lines will soon come online, and wind power has just gotten a lot cheaper.
Wind and solar have come down so much in price that utilities are choosing to go out and purchase them because they are economically the best choice for ratepayers.
And the second reason, Southeast Wyoming happens to be very close to certain renewable energy demanding states like Colorado. And it's part of the Western grid as more states look to renewables. Naughton says he's not surprised by the project's pushback, though, as places like Albany County aren't as used to big infrastructure projects.
We have a limited experience with this, and much of that was done a long time ago. So first reaction is, yeah, that this is not something we want to do.
But Naughton compares it to the federal highway system. He says in the 1950s, most people were worried what fast-paced roads could do to a town or community.
We look 2 generations, 3 generations later, and I don't think you'll find too many people that think the federal highway system is a bad thing.
Plus, Naughton says the coming projects will provide a much-needed economic boost, both for the county and the state. Railtie promises to bring nearly $180 million in tax benefit over its 35-year lifespan. He says the surge of new southeastern wind projects could continue for another 5 to 7 years. The Railtie project is scheduled to be built in 2021 and operational by 2022. There will be multiple opportunities for public comment. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Loss of revenue is a major topic of conversation as lawmakers prepare for the upcoming budget session. But things have been looking bright in a few counties. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on how one county has been trying to capitalize on some remarkable growth in the past year.
Jim Robinson, principal economist for the Wyoming Economic Analysis Division, says when he looks at Wyoming's economy in the coming year, it's probably not the news anyone wants to hear.
It's still growing. We're still seeing expansion in the state, but clearly is at a much slower rate. And this is, comparing it to where we were, like, say, 6 months ago.
He says 6 months ago, the state was looking at a 3% expansion, but now it looks closer to 1%. But Robinson says that doesn't take away from the fact that the past year has been especially good to one county in particular.
Well, of course, the county that's the last 2 or 3 years has been really seeing the impact of the oil drilling activity in the state has been Converse County.
Robinson says so far in fiscal year 2020, Converse County is $11.2 million ahead of its sales and use tax collections based on year-to-year comparisons. Robertson says tracking growth through sales and use tax shows more than just the business side of a local economy.
I like that number because that reflects spending by not only consumers, but also by businesses as well. So when you see that number jump up or being ahead of where it was last year, that tells you something about that there's something going on in the economy there.
Historically, Converse County has relied on energy, agriculture, and hunting and fishing tourism to support itself. Robert Short, chairman of the Converse County Commissioners, says it's been a boom-bust economy for many years. And starting in 2008, there was a growing desire to develop oil and natural gas in the county.
That exploration got very serious around 2013, 2014. And then, of course, we had a dramatic commodity travesty. The bottom fell out of the pricing for oil specifically, and gas, coal, and uranium. For whatever reason, we had the trifecta of terrible in commodity pricing associated with energy. And we saw a massive exodus of investment dollars and development in the county.
But oil and gas production has started picking up again in the past couple of years.
We have seen a dramatic increase in 18 and 19 in infrastructure investment in Converse. We went from approximately 350 million cubic feet of natural gas production capacity to we're sitting at about 1.2 billion right now.
Short says the growth comes with its own set of challenges. The biggest challenge? There isn't enough workers. State economist Robinson says that will have an impact on businesses.
In other words, you're going to see salaries and wages go up as employers try to attract, you know, from a very limited pool of people available to come to work for them.
He adds some of those same factors might put off a new business from coming to town. But Short says, on the flip side, there are a number of available jobs, and that has brought in workers from other counties and even other states. More people coming in means the area needs more housing. And as Wyoming Public Radio has reported, housing in Douglas has been tight, especially for out-of-state workers. Short says building new housing is a gamble for developers that just doesn't always fit with the boom-bust economy that comes with oil and gas production. That's why commissioners decided to put their focus on long-term investments and infrastructure.
So our road and bridge department, of course, we've invested in them more because we've poor-boyed it, so to speak, for quite a few years. So in the last couple of years, we've started upgrading our fleet, both equipment-wise and manpower-wise.
They're also working on property development in the hopes to attract a wide range of businesses. But Jim Robinson with the state's Economic Analysis Division makes it clear that the state's economy is slowing down. He says December's oil rig counts are down compared to November.
It's certainly tied into our drilling activity in the state. The oil and gas jobs have stayed about the same every month this year. Despite seeing all that growth in oil production, we're not seeing a corresponding increase in oil and gas jobs. They are able to produce more with fewer resources, including, you know, jobs.
Robinson says as the state looks ahead in the year, the forecast for sales and use tax collection will likely come in as expected. But beyond that, remains unclear. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Douglas.
When we come back, we'll visit a workshop in Lander and meet a special folk artist. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. It isn't easy keeping America's folk arts alive, but the Wyoming Arts Council has been doing their best to preserve Wyoming's. Each year, they give out grants to folk artists who pass on their knowledge to the next generation. Jack Meese braids rawhide to create beautiful horse tack like reins and hackamores, and now is teaching Soliana Abernathy too. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards visited Meese's workshop in Lander.
When I came back from Korea in 52, I went to work on oil rigs and so forth, and then I went to Nevada and was working on a ranch and met a guy there that done braiding, and it intrigued me, so I thought I'd like to do it, and I bought a book and learned how to do it, and I've been doing some ever since. And about 14 years ago, or 15, I started teaching, and I've had over 70 students and 6 grants from the Arts, Parks, and History.
Can you talk just a little bit about rawhide braiding? So what is the kind of the purpose for it? What's the end product?
Nowadays, it's probably called art. Years ago, when they did that, it was for function. The guys that braided, most of them was actual working cowboys. The Moors are credited with starting braiding, and they brought it into Spain during the Moor Wars. And then, of course, it came into America and South America and so forth. And then, of course, the American Cowboys is going to copy something that they like. They're going to copy it. La Rieta in Spanish, we turned that into Lariat. A hackamore is La Hakima. Well, then we call it a hackamore. So cowboys were just something that was easier for them to say. They was actually using that gear. And when I started, that's what I was doing, is making what I was actually using till I started teaching classes, and then we went more into art.
I wonder if you can talk to me a little bit about your relationship to Soliana and how you guys met, either one of you.
I started coming out here 2015, once a week. learning how to braid with Jack. And we started with the 4-string, 8-string, 12-string. And then he taught me the smaller pineapple, the long pineapple braid. My first project with Jack was a pair of leather reins with rawhide extensions to go on the bridle bit. Yeah, and I saw...
And do you have horses? Or is that it? Was that kind of the interest for you?
Yeah, it was definitely my interest, was to learn how to make my own gear and to fix my own gear. So I came out of it for function. I still feel like my motivation is for function versus art.
And did you grow up around horses? And
I did. I grew up on a cattle ranch.
Where did you grow up?
Here, in Lander.
Okay. Yeah, and so have you found that the stuff that you're making, how does it compare to, like, the store-bought stuff?
It feels a lot better in your hands. It's already softer, more flexible, and you can customize it. If you have a longer horse, you can make the reins longer, and you can just figure out what works best.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about the mentorship relationship, and mm-hmm. what is that relationship, and why is it an important relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, one, Jack is very patient. If you don't figure it out the first time, the second time, the 10th time, he sticks with you as long as you show up and continue to do the work.
Why is it that you choose to be a mentor?
Oh, it gives me something to do. I guess you can say it gives me a reason for living. Since the wife passed away, I need something to occupy my time, and television is not that great, so... I've had over 70 students, and I think there's been 7 men. The rest of them are women.
So I wonder if we can, you know, maybe do a little tour and maybe some demonstrations of what it is that you guys do.
Sure.
Okay. What's the place to start? You want to show me what you've got here?
Yeah. This was my first set of reins that I made.
Wow, those are beautiful.
So it's made with kangaroo leather, kangaroo rawhide, and this rawhide here is stained with beet juice. That makes it red, and this is coffee stained. So yeah, this is the short pineapple. This is actually the pineapple knot as well, the wear leather piece. Yeah, all of that, the rawhide has to be wet to be able to work with it. A good level of wetness, not too wet, it'll break, but you can't work with it dry.
So Lynn, if you want to show maybe a 4-string round braid.
So this is just cord that you kind of can learn on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got that 7-year-old.
Right, that's coming in and practicing here.
Yeah, yeah.
So a 7-year-old can use this.
Uh-huh. I don't know if I can explain it.
Right, yeah.
You can do it.
Right. But it's kind of creating kind of a rounder mm-hmm. sort of look.
Yeah, it does.
By using, and this is with 4
strings.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like braiding, but it's as you're coming around, you're choosing another.
Yeah, you got your 3 here, and you're going to bring your back string. That's what you know comes through, is the one that's furthest back.
Right. My daughter would like to be able to do that with her hair, I bet.
Let's say that this is going to be an under 2/2 braid. I reach through there and get that like that. I reach through here, lay them over there, reach through there, lay that, grab those 3, reach through here. See how the difference of the time saving that I'm doing there?
Yeah.
There's no false move, and I'm kicking back the string that has to come next, so there's no way of getting it.
Accidentally getting it in there.
Yeah, you see how?
You're making mistakes.
One of the first things I tell my students is always be thinking, how can you do this faster and still do it good? But you can see where that's tightening up.
Yeah, that's getting tight.
Yeah. And what I'm doing is I'm pushing at the same time I'm pulling.
Yeah. Got your thumb sort of there at the bottom.
Yeah.
And so once they have learned on the cords, then are you able to get them going on, like, where's the actual strings? Where do you kind of set them up doing that?
Well, this is a humidor here. What that is it's got water in there with Purex. And if I put them strings in there and put the lid on that, tomorrow morning I might dampen them just a little bit and put them in there. they'll be just about right for braiding. Yeah,
so you kind of leave them overnight and...
Yeah.
And it's got...
I can leave them in there 2 or 3 weeks and they don't mildew.
Yeah. And is this kind of some of the wider strips?
Yeah, that's just... It seemed like it, you get a bunch of this, you never use it. You think you'll eventually use it, but you don't.
Yeah.
But that gives you an idea.
You kind of keep it just in case.
Yeah.
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 So these are some of your scraps.
But you can see what... And to cut that with 10 snips, like I say, it won't hardly cut it, but you can cut it with a knife if you put that stress on it.
Ah, interesting. Yeah.
Jack also made his own string cutter machine.
Oh, really?
So that makes the process a lot easier.
I'll show you how I cut strings till I started teaching students to do it. See the notches in there?
Yeah.
That would bolt where that bolt is there.
Uh-huh.
I'd bolt that down to there. But this would be bolted down. I just set my whatever width fits that and set that the width I want the string. Just pull. It's just I've had 11, 12 year old kids do it the first time they try it.
You know, the stuff that you make, do you sell it?
No. But
no,
I've
fun.
Given away a lot of stuff over the years, yeah. But
you prefer to gift it as opposed to sell it.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. If you have to do something, it seems like it's kind of a burden. I can't just do it when I want to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, guys, thanks so much for showing me your shop and telling me all about this. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with rawhide braiders Jack Meese and Soliana Abernathy, last year's recipients of the Wyoming Arts Council's Folk and Traditional Art Mentoring Grant. You can see Meese's work at the State Museum in Cheyenne.
In a moment, we'll hear a story about how telemedicine can help with opioid abuse, and we will discuss an effort to make arts and the humanities a bigger part of the economy. This is Open Spaces. You're listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. In a rural state like Wyoming, state health care providers are no longer newcomers to utilizing telehealth to help bridge distances. But Cody Regional Health is experimenting using remote technology for an opioid treatment that is generally underutilized in the nation. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
There's like this massive television that I show up on. So everybody else is, you know, normal human size. And then I'm on the TV where, you know, it shows me like from the shoulder up. So I'm like this giant in the room.
That's Krista Blau. She's a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner at Cody Regional Health. She's describing how she appears to patients during medication-assisted treatments, or a MAT, that is provided through telehealth.
I mean, it's like it's a little weird, but... But it's great, it's predictable, it's consistent, and I feel close with them, and surprisingly, the patients report that they feel close with me as well.
A MAT program is the combination of prescribing medications used to treat opioid use disorder, combined with group therapy. Many experts, like Sarah Hawk with RTI International, refers to it as the most effective way to treat opioid use disorder. But there have been barriers to the treatment becoming widely used.
There are not enough providers, and you know, there is some stigma around opioid use disorder.
There's a stigma because MAT uses a controlled substance for its treatment. Nationally, there are only about 6,000 providers who have the waiver that allows them to prescribe the medication required for the treatment. In Wyoming, there are 85 prescribing providers. And there's one more problem.
Also, reimbursement for MAT is across the board.
But Krista Blau says the retention rate for patients that utilize the program show that it can be very successful.
Nationwide, with true MAT programs, relapse rates are less than 25%. And that's good. When they relapse, they die.
Cody Regional Health has seen similar numbers with its MAP program, which is good news because some patients were driving over 2 hours weekly to get treatment. Dr. Brett Martin is a certified addiction practitioner at Cody Regional Health. He says they decided to apply for a grant to make it easier on patients.
With all of the opiate epidemic in the United States, the federal government has brought a lot of money to individual states. And when they did that here in Wyoming, we applied for a grant.
Cody's grant funding came through Wyoming Department of Health and will last for 2 years. The grant helps with covering treatment costs, and they used a lot of money to get the technology. For Martin and Blau, there are definitely challenges to providing care remotely through a screen. For instance, it takes a while for patients to get comfortable with it. But Dr. Martin says it's the way of the future.
We've had patients driving to us from southern Montana, from Thermopolis, from Warland, from the Basin and Grable areas, driving to our program weekly, which has a lot of barriers, weather, the cost of transportation. And so we've been able to take the treatment to their rural area and provide that to the patient for free.
And while there are still a few kinks to work out, like having to see the patient in person for the first consultation, the folks at Cody Regional Health believe this model is preferable than their patients driving hours every week. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Wyoming has been working towards economic diversification, and one way to do that is to make Wyoming's culture, arts, and humanities programs a bigger part of the effort. Recently, the former CEO of the Wyoming Business Council, Sean Reese, joined Wyoming Humanities to further this effort. The director of Wyoming Humanities is Shannon Smith, and she explains the idea.
About 2 years ago, my board of directors, who are based all around the state, and I were focusing on the impact we wanted to make on Wyoming. And at the same time, the Endow Council for Economic Diversification was really ramping up. And we started meeting with Endow to talk about how we contribute, the cultural and creative network of Wyoming contributes to the quality of life. And it soon became clear to us that, hey, wait a minute, we are an economic sector, and we should be looked at both as contributing to our state's economy and attracting other industries because they want to live in a place that's filled with art and culture. But we should be measured and viewed as an economic driver. And so that's where we started this idea. And so I met quite frequently, along with Mike Lang and the Arts Council, with the Endow Committee. And you'll see in the Endow report that they structured the pillars that they recommend for the state to explore. One of them is the creative network, the creative economy. And so that's really now become a focus of my organization.
So I know you talked with Sean Reese, who's here with us as well. Sean used to be, of course, the CEO of the Wyoming Business Council. And Sean, give me your thoughts. Is this a sector that maybe if we spend a little more time on could have some big returns for the state?
Well, I think it already does. When you look at the arts and culture contribution to employment in Wyoming, we are ranked number second in the U.S. First is New York. So already it's a contributor, I think almost 11,500 jobs. The goal is to increase that contribution to the economy to from 5% to 10%. But I think what's intriguing to me is that it works at a number of different levels. It's not only an economic sector that contributes to Wyoming's economy, but as Shannon mentioned, the quality of life piece is important for our communities to be able to retain and attract talent and entrepreneurs and families who want to live in cool places. But also, as the workforce changes, as it evolves, and technology takes away things that we had been doing, the importance of liberal arts and the humanities as a key component of an individual's background is only going to increase. And we hear that from corporations like Apple and Google and Microsoft, the importance of humanities and liberal arts. It's not just the technology, it's that human element. So it's working on all of these different levels as an economic driver, as a workforce driver, community development. And then, of course, there's just the intrinsic benefits for humanity of being well-rounded.
Can you cite a couple of towns that maybe have had success? I've got one in mind that's up in the northwest corner of the state, but I'm curious, outside of a Jackson, are there others that have done this and had some luck with it?
Well, I think that there definitely are some great examples around the state, and the one that pops into my mind right off the bat is Sheridan. Sheridan has really built an economic development strategy around culture and the arts, and they've brought in foundations. They brought in Sheridan College. They brought in their industry, and it's helped attract new industry. It's helped bring in tourism, so it complements that, and it just makes a really interesting community to visit and to live in.
Shannon, you talk with public officials across the state all the time. Is this a hard sell? Do people generally get that this is a good thing to focus on?
It's really not a hard sell, and that's because in all 99 communities, there's a historical society or a working artist who makes some or all of their income from this sector. And as soon as you sit down, it's almost magical because people all of a sudden relate it to what they experience and what they understand about their own communities. And that's how it worked within Dow. I mean, literally, we came in, Mike Lang and I came in and started having conversations with these really smart people that are trying to figure out, you know, creative ways for the state to move forward. And they all clicked with it almost instantly.
Are there some challenges out there, either one of you on this? Sean, maybe starting with you, are there some challenges? And I keep thinking maybe some of our smaller places and all that is it going to be hard for them to do this?
I don't think it's going to be hard at all. I think it's just a matter of encouraging and sparking conversations between different groups, cross-pollinating what's happening in one small town to what's happening in another. I think where there is some challenges to change our mindset about economic diversification. It's not just about physical infrastructure. It's also about that human infrastructure. And I think there's some exciting opportunities in that conversation. When we think about the complexity of Wyoming's economic condition, it takes complex thinking to be able to rise to that challenge. And that's where the humanities fits in. I think that's where the liberal arts are so important, is to be able to help people to wrap their minds around these complex issues, identify patterns, look to the past, look to arts and culture. So there's so many great opportunities out there, but I think small towns are really beneficiaries of having strong humanities programs.
Challenges, Shannon?
One of the biggest challenges is there's only, a quarter of a million working adults in our state. There's no way private funding from individuals is going to be able to make something like this take off at this time. So we have to come up with some creative public-private structures and collaborations. And that's really where we're taking off and starting to have these conversations with our legislators and the governor and trying to explain that we can do this. And it's got to be a little bit of both. And it's how the NEA and the NEH were founded back in 1965, is they said that art and culture is primarily a private enterprise, but the public organizations of our nation also need to be involved in order to allow everybody to have access.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about that. I mean, there's the money aspect, I would think, that comes into play too. But could you also do some things with policy and just, you know, that type of thing?
Absolutely. I think a fundamental piece of the humanities is that it's an underpinning of democracy and civic engagement. And so I think as we work to develop the next generation of leaders, or we, again, wrap our minds around these complex problems, this is democratic intercourse. This is how people solve problems in our country. And that civic engagement is something that the humanities can help build up.
Where do we go from here, Shannon?
Well, one of the things we're working on, of course, we are focusing on the public grants that we give to the cultural network of the state. But I think the biggest thing I'm excited about is building this collaborative network with public radio, public television, the Arts Council, the Cultural Trust Fund, and the Office of Tourism in order for us to really strengthen this infrastructure that will then go out and support the creative and cultural economy of Wyoming.
Shannon Smith and Sean Reese, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having us.
Avalanches are one of the Mountain West's most dangerous natural disasters. This winter, 8 people have already died across our region. But there are ways to increase your odds of surviving an avalanche. Our Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie tagged along with a special class in Utah to find out.
Imagine you're with a friend on top of a cold, snowy mountain. It's 13 degrees, no wind, but beautiful. Your friend kicks off and begins skiing down a slope, but then...
Help! Help! My friend! Help!
She triggers a massive avalanche. That's Lily Wolf, and don't worry, she's not really in danger. Wolf is an instructor with the nonprofit Utah Avalanche Center, and she's role-playing an avalanche with a couple of students. She's leading a rescue class near Park City, and the victim is actually just an old backpack. But it's buried somewhere out there in the snow. Its avalanche beacon is on, and the students are using special transceivers to try and find it.
What are your numbers? You gotta communicate with each other.
They scramble towards the signal, pinpoint it, and begin shoveling. All is going according to plan until one of the students takes his gloves off. Wolf gently chastises him.
It's gotta be some cold hands. Have you ever shoveled a lot without gloves on?
No.
I did once. End up with some bloody hands.
Did you?
Pretty darn quick. You won't make that mistake again.
There's a lot of tips like this to remember when you're trying to find someone who's trapped in an avalanche. Like, don't panic. Make a plan. Be safe and move quickly, because most people die within an hour of being buried. Chad Bracklesberg is executive director of the Utah Avalanche Center. He says the most common cause of death in an avalanche isn't getting crushed. It's asphyxiation.
So it's not that you suffocate, it's actually that you run out of oxygen in the snowpack. It is, I guess, similar to drowning as a feeling, but different because you're actually not inhaling anything. You're running out of oxygen instead.
So if you don't want to die this way, Bracklesberg says one of the best things you can do is avoid avalanches in the first place. That means paying attention to red flags, like not going backcountry skiing after a snowstorm or looking out for wind blowing in huge drifts of snow.
Wind is a big one. So the wind was howling today. Wind can move 10 times more snow than what falls out of the sky.
There are also special forecasts that warn backcountry skiers, snowboarders, and snowmobilers about the potential danger for avalanches on any given day. Despite all the precautions, though, people can still get trapped and killed. It's a lesson student Brett Yotkeman knows personally. In the 1990s, he lost a friend in an avalanche in Colorado.
When the avalanche went, he tumbled over rocks and cliffs and died from the trauma.
And it was traumatic for Yotkeman. He stepped back from backcountry skiing for nearly 2 decades while he raised his kids. But now the sport is drawing him back.
I love backcountry skiing for the peace, getting away from kind of the resorts and all the crowds.
But Yakumin wants to make sure he's skiing in the backcountry safely. So he and 17 others are here learning the basics of avalanche rescue. They use long probes to find survivors under the snow. They figure out the ins and outs of their emergency transceivers, and they learn how to dig efficiently and quickly as a team.
Zip up your jackets, put your hoods on. You're gonna get some snow in your face.
The person in front begins scooping out the snow while the others get rid of the debris. They switch out every minute or so. It's tough work. After all, 1 cubic meter of densely packed snow can weigh nearly a ton. That's why it's so hard to free yourself if you get stuck in an avalanche. But executive director Chad Bracklesberg argues that classes like this are helping keep the number of deaths pretty low across the Mountain West, even as sports like backcountry skiing become more popular.
It is still the most deadly natural disaster in Utah, but based on this growth, we're really happy that, you know, education, awareness, gear, all these things are keeping people safer and preventing that rise in fatalities.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Park City, Utah.
a moment, we'll wrap up the program. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's known as the Night of the Grizzlies, and it happened in Glacier National Park more than 50 years ago. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, the repercussions of that incident are still being felt today, especially for women.
Back in the 80s, Caroline Byrd worked for the U.S. Forest Service on a seasonal trail crew just outside of Yellowstone National Park.
You know, here we were out in the wilderness for 10 days at a time.
Doing really hard labor, she says, that was super satisfying. One summer, she stayed on late into the fall. It was hunting season.
And that's when we ran across this hunter's camp where the hunter had left his, you know, he's just put his groceries inside the wall tent. He left.
Byrd says the hunter had gone back into town, and while he was away, a mama bear and her cub had ransacked the camp. Bear encounters were rare at the time. That's why a special agent came all the way from Colorado to investigate.
He was aghast that women were working in the backcountry where there were bears, and we were like, no, that's not the issue. The issue is this hunter left his food and bears got into it.
That's when the Forest Service told Byrd and three other women on her crew that they would no longer be able to work in bear country. And here's the kicker, while they were on their periods.
Why are we getting restricted like this when this has nothing to do with the fact that there are women on a timber crew working in bear country?
The women were outraged, so they wrote to the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Office in Denver, and the policy was rescinded shortly afterwards. But where exactly did the idea that menstruating women are at a greater risk in bear country come from? That goes back to one fateful night in 1967, the night of the Grizzlies.
There was the two attacks in Glacier National Park where two different women were killed by two different grizzly bears on the same night.
That's Kerry Gunther. He's a bear biologist for Yellowstone National Park. He says the attacks caused the National Park Service to start enforcing regulations for how campers stored food or anything else with an odor.
But it also sparked speculation. Having two fatalities in one night was just so rare that people were groping for a reason. And one theory that came about was menstruation might have led to these two fatal bear attacks in Glacier.
Only one of the women killed was on her period. But the theory stuck. That's why decades later, Caroline Byrd and her female colleagues were told they couldn't work in bear country while they were menstruating. And why, in 1988, as a graduate student in environmental studies, Byrd tried to debunk the myth.
I ran a whole statistical analysis of, is there anything out there that shows that bears react differently to women than to men? And, you know, it came out really strong that no, bears do not respond or react or in any way change their behavior based on the gender of the person that they are encountering.
This lack of definitive evidence remains true today, but so does the myth. Versions of it are easy to find. Just ask some women on the University of Wyoming's campus.
I've heard that with swimming in the ocean, with sharks and stuff.
No, I mean, I've heard it before, but I think as a joke.
Oh, I actually have heard this.
And it's possible Yellowstone's website may not be helping. It does have a whole page dedicated to menstruating women in bear country that cites Byrd's statistical analysis, but it also says women can take precautions if they're concerned, like using tampons instead of pads. Margaret Seeley is a reporter that has written about the bears and periods myth.
I do feel like the way it's worded on the website right now is problematic.
The website also references a study from the late 70s that tested how polar bears would react to menstrual blood in different scenarios, like how a caged polar bear reacted to a used tampon versus other odors. But both Byrd and Seeley say the research methods were flawed, and Seeley says including the study on the website perpetuates the misconception.
It's continuing to support and promote the myth that polar bears or bears are attracted or affected by menstruating women, which again is different than a blood-soaked tampon.
Seeley is an avid hiker,
before her own reporting, she was pretty sure that being out in bear country while menstruating was dangerous. And she says fears like this keep women out of the woods, and that becomes an issue of quality of life.
I don't belong in this air-conditioned office. I belong out in the world, and I belong in nature.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When StoryCorps came to Jackson recently, Jay Edwards sat down with his daughter Melody and told her about the time in the early 60s when he and Melody's mother hitchhiked from California to Mexico before hitchhiking up to Iowa to meet her mother's family.
You hitchhiked out to Iowa to visit my mom's family. And can you talk about that first time that you went out, what was her family's reaction to
you
showing up?
Your grandfather beat me up and your uncle took me to town from the farm.
How long were you there?
So we must have just got there and then there was a row in the house.
Well, how did that even come about? Why did they suddenly decide to?
I wasn't privy to that. I was outside.
Uh-huh.
And so the bunch of them came out, the bunch of them. And then there was a confrontation, me with a baseball bat.
Oh, and, dear. Defending yourself or what?
Well, I thought I might have to. I didn't know what I was into, you know. And so your grandfather said, put that bat down, and then whacked me one.
Yeah.
And it didn't knock me down, didn't knock me out. But at that point, I had realized, I'm not going to hit this guy in the head, you know.
Yeah.
He's the father of the woman I'm in love with.
Yeah.
You know. So.
Yeah.
I didn't hit him.
Right.
With the baseball.
That's
and
good.
Then Gary gave me Gary gave me a ride into town. I went into
And what was the conversation like in the car ride there?
I was crying. Yeah. And there wasn't much of a conversation.
Yeah.
So he
were
took
you
me
were
to,
crying because you were being
thing, don't ask me why. It was a bad scene, that's why.
Yeah.
You know.
Were they like you should never see my mom again?
Oh yeah, yeah.
What problem did they have with you?
Can't tell you.
You were a hippie.
There were no hippies. The term hippie was not
around
was not a term at that point. You know, that was a herb
beatnik or anything like
that. It wasn't even that. It was just a guy hitchhiking with their daughter.
Yeah.
That's about all it would have been at that point. And, you know, I was a lot younger.
And so you went back to Ann Arbor?
First of all, I went into Afton, got a hotel room there. And called your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the days of the old ring, ding, 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 ring, ding, 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 you know. And so your grandfather listened in on the conversation and sent the sheriff to my room. And the sheriff put me in a squad car and took me to the county line. And it was pouring down rain, dropped me off. And I got a ride and I hitchhiked back to Ann Arbor.
And so then how did you and my mom end up getting back together?
Well, your mom basically lied to her parents and said she was going to go stay with her friend in New York. And then so she just got off in Chicago, got on the Wolverine Express, went to the station in Ann Arbor, depot in Ann Arbor, and it was the greatest day of my life.
That's Jay and Melody Edwards talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. This piece was produced by Alex Schaefer.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This show will be archived on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can find the show, individual segments, and links to previous programs. Just click on Open Spaces.
You'll never miss an episode if you sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. We also invite you to check out our news stories on the station Facebook page. You can follow the station and all of our reporters on Twitter and Instagram. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.